On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Hello. This is an unannounced special. I do many interviews with guests during the course of any given year. I usually do a little over 500 interviews every year with 500 different people, and I have 500 migraines. I've been doing this for nearly three decades. I can't multiply. That's a lot. 30 times 500 is, I don't know, it's a lot. If I had a dollar for every interview I do, I wouldn't have to do this. Get it? Anyway, over those years and over those many interviews, it's been fascinating. I've learned so much. So this program is what we call an overstock. These are very recent interviews that were just done, but we just don't have time to air them all on all different shows. So I'm just packing a lot of interviews here. There's about six of them or something like that that we're going to feature during this program. They're brand new interviews. Hopefully the information from doctors and experts and all different kinds of people about buying houses and staying healthy and financing your life and things like that. It's going to be fascinating, I suppose. So here you go. Here are the interviews, one after the other. Have a good time. Enjoy yourself. Have something to eat. Have a drink. Here we go.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing. Whatever.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
How are you today?
Doing very well. Thank you. Yourself?
I'm great, thank you. This is Major John J. Adams, and he is a distinguished serving. What is your background, sir?
So, been in the Army for over 25 years.
Oh, my.
I started off as an enlisted soldier, joined right out of high school, combat engineers. Did that, got out. Decided to use the GI Bill to pay for school, went back to school, became an officer, commissioned as a second lieutenant in the infantry, went off and served for a while in the active duty, then joined the reserve after that, and then now I've kind of come back into active duty, only I work for the reserve now, and I work in public relations marketing now for the past few years, but an array of different opportunities, as you can hear, in my career in the military. So
very cool.
It's been a great ride.
Okay. So he knows of what he speaks, is what we're saying here. And there's a race coming up, I understand, called the Spartan Race. What is that?
So the Spartan Race is one of the country's premier adventure race series. And, for example, they have many different types of races that will go out throughout the country. They have the Sprint, the Super, the Beast, the Ultra Beast. And each of these courses can range from about 3 miles all the way up to marathon distances with 20-plus obstacles, you know, per course designed to challenge you both mentally and physically. So,
wow.
Very extensive race.
So your connection to it would be that it is very Army training-like, I would assume.
Absolutely. Just from the sound, when you hear obstacles or challenges, physical, mental, all of those are synonymous with military service. Having to overcome challenges, whether it's an individual challenge or team-level challenge. So we saw that in Spartan, and we approached that. We had conversations. We thought this is a great fit. So the Army Reserve will be out there talking to folks. Because the services between what we do and what Spartan folks and those participants are doing are just, it's a perfect fit for us. So we're really excited about joining them this year.
Now, not all of us, and I'm speaking for myself, would it be able to endure more than probably about 15 seconds of this this activity. But yet, what can the layperson get from this as far as attitude and what they're watching here?
So, if I heard you correctly, we would ask that if someone prepare for these type of events, we have something in the military called, and mainly the Army, called the Performance Triad. And that's three main pillars. It's sleep, quality of sleep, it's engaging in activity, and then the right nutrition.
Okay.
So let's take a look at that. And if you get out and you go on to Spartan.com, you take a look at the races that will be in your area, and you're the one that you're thinking about going to, take a look at the course, take a look at the obstacles on that course, and that'll give you an idea of what to expect. And then you want to go back and probably, you know, start training those core muscle movements, those core muscle groups surrounding those events that you're about to undergo, and getting something similar. You're not going to get them exactly because that's just an elaborate course. You can't build that in your backyard. Well, most people can't.
Right.
And then again, the sleep and the nutrition, making sure leading up to the event, especially a week before, you want to make sure you're getting plenty of water, you're eating proper foods, you're getting good rest. And if you do all those things, you get out there, I think the adrenaline, all the Army folks, everybody out there, the other participants, it just gives you this adrenaline rush. You're pumped up, and that should carry you the rest of the way, hopefully.
When I watch other people train for things, whether it be the Olympics or a rigorous course like this, there are certain qualities that these people have that I apparently don't. And how would this make me, as a person that wouldn't participate in this, how can it make me feel like in life itself I can prepare myself for things?
Great question. I think, first of all, you have to make a personal decision that you're going to want to participate. Now, whether that's as an individual, or if you have a group of friends or family or coworkers that you'd like to engage and get them out there with you and go in it together as a team, you got to make that decision up front.
Yep.
And then once you get into that, kind of that flow leading up to the race, and you have all of the training in place, you go through that race and you're overcoming these things as they're happening, and you don't have to be perfect at it. There's no time limit. I mean, there are folks who compete for a record, but really most of the folks out there are going through it to have a great time, to build that camaraderie, to build that kind of friendship and accomplishment that you've achieved something. And that's what most folks walk away from. They cross that finish line, they get their race medal, they've done all the obstacles, they're muddy, they're sweaty, they're totally tired, worn out, and then, you know, that is just an incredible feeling that you did it, that you were able to overcome something that you were fearful of, overcome something that was physically and mentally challenging, and that's so much like the Army Reserve Service. All of those things, when you approach the Army, you're worried about those things, and once you get through all of them, you realize you did it, and now you're on a great path to success with the Army Reserve or the Army, just like Spartan. That's kind of a mini feeling, but we love that. It's the same thing.
So it's a feeling of self-achievement. Like you set out to do something and you actually do succeed.
Yes, absolutely, 100%.
Okay. How is it, just out of curiosity, how is the Army Reserve different than the active Army?
Great question. So part-time service in the Army Reserve, really it's going to open up a lot of doors for you, both on your civilian career and your military career. So part service really comes down to this. It means working 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year of training.
Yeah.
So you go off to basic training, you go off to go to your specialty school training, and then you come back home. That all part is the same as an active duty. But the thing is, when active duty folks, they go on to go to a fort or a station, a base somewhere, and they go on and serve full-time. You come back home to your hometown or your community, wherever you have a job, and you start working your job, your civilian job.
Right.
And you serve, the thing is, with the Army Reserve, you serve that 1 week in a month, 2 weeks out of the year.
Right.
There, that's the main difference.
Is there ever a situation where someone from the Army Reserve is called up for 24-7 duty?
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, you know, depending on where our nation is and its mission set and what the requirements are of that mission set, they may require the capabilities that the Army Reserve provides the main Army.
Right.
And sometimes that means you have to get called up to active duty, go off, whether that's a deployment or whether that's a deployment and like in the United States to help support a hospital or help support some engineering assets or something of the technical background. So we have situations like that based on what's going on out there. Yep.
Okay, so because you've been trained and you're ready to go, so to speak. So,
yes.
All right. Wow. Kind of like the difference between going to summer camp for the day and then going home, or going to sleepaway camp.
In different kinds of
very,
different
very simplistic, simplistic
analogy,
view,
I,
right?
It's a kind of analogy like that. But the thing about summer camp, though, you're not walking back after you come back for part time and
right,
having, you know,
right,
up to $50,000 of your student loans.
Oh, there's benefits. Okay, the benefits.
There's
are involved.
Massive benefits. So yeah, medical insurance. I mean, you name it, school
okay,
money, different
okay,
things.
Okay.
So. And that's a big concern for kids who are
sure,
going to school these days that
sure,
want to go to college. They're worried about the debt they're going to incur, so
yeah,
we kind of help them with that.
The great thing about it, that experience, besides the physical aspect of it and building yourself up physically, is this incredible ability to be a team member. And I've always said, I talk to a lot of veterans and VA organizations and such, and I don't understand why everybody in the military service isn't hired for jobs when they come back automatically, because they already have that quality of working with others, being a team, being devoted to your team, watching each other's behind for you. I mean, those are qualities of life, aren't they?
I couldn't agree more. Those qualities that you're describing are what we call the intangible qualities
mm-hmm,
that you gain from military service.
Yeah.
Those can't be taught in schools, whether high schools or collegiate level.
Right.
These are the type of things that military personnel, whether you're Navy, Army, Air Force, wherever, you learn. You have to make incredible decisions
mm-hmm,
with very limited information
mm-hmm,
very quickly. That could result in, you know,
yeah,
pretty serious, you know, results.
Yeah.
Where do you know, so all of these things that you learn, this teamwork, this how to handle pressure, how
mm-hmm,
to lead others under stressful situations, how to work and communicate, you know, collectively
mm-hmm,
and coherently
mm-hmm,
through different cultures, you know, through different types of, you know, nations and so on. That's something that we would bring, or
right,
military folks
mm-hmm,
learn
mm-hmm,
and gain those skills.
Mm-hmm.
And when they leave the military, they have those available.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more with your assessment.
Yeah.
It's something that it's unique. And you'll see the camaraderie, that kind of unspoken bond that many military members have just by looking at each other and understanding that they have service. They understand that they each know certain things
mm-hmm,
without even having to talk about it.
Right.
So I agree with that.
Very good.
So it's another one of those benefits. It's
yeah,
an intangible benefit.
Large one.
But it's something that you will learn yep, from service.
We're running short of time. Where do we get more information about this?
So, great. Spartan.com for all the upcoming races throughout the Boston area. And then if you're interested in learning more about the Army Reserve, it's armyreserve.com. And you'll get all the information you need to know about part-time service and full-time success in your life.
Great. So, Major John Adams, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Take care. Bye-bye. Hello, Cindy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Ron?
I'm great, thank you. Cindy Bear is president and CEO of Brookdale Senior Living. And we're talking about Mother's Day coming up rather soon. And we've got a connection to what we're talking about as far as Mother's Day is concerned. And that's giving thanks and recognizing what some people do that goes a little bit beyond.
It's absolutely true. Do you know that 75% of all caregivers are women? And that most responsibilities fall on the daughter or the daughter-in-law. So it really is a lot of thanks for those associates. But I also think that it's amazing to give the gift of Mother's Day of care and to be able to bridge back to that relationship with your mom, not to have to worry about meals or medication or doctor's appointments, to really have the gift of being able to focus on your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the gift that we at Brookdale give our seniors and their families.
What can one do on Mother's Day for something like this that would be special?
You know, I would say start thinking about senior living options. If you think about what's special between a mother and a daughter, it's really the relationship that's special. And so looking for that solution that allows mom to be everything that she can be and allows you to have that relationship with your mom again. And so at Brookdale, we like to match the care options that we provide for seniors and their families to what the need is. It could be independent living, it could be assisted living, memory care, or it could even be skilled nursing at home. And if you want to think about how to get started on finding that solution for you and your mom, go to brookdale.com, and we've got all the information there to start the conversation, to find the right community, to find that truly perfect gift for you and your mom.
There are a lot of misconceptions as to this type of care, I'm sure, where as soon as you mention someone, a loved one moving out of the house and going to another location, that all of a sudden is a roadblock. But some of these, my mother was in assisted living. She was so happy. I mean, she was independent, did what she wanted. Yet, if she needed something, they were there at the touch of a button. It's as simple as that sometimes, isn't it?
It really is. And I think that it's often a scary decision and often a decision that's filled with guilt. But what I will tell you is that most of our residents and families, their single regret, and mine too, is that you wait too long.
Yeah.
What you don't really think about is that as parents age, their worlds get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
They lose a lot of the things that make them happy.
Yeah.
And by putting them in a supporting and caring environment, they're able to truly live the best life that's possible for them. I know that with my mom, I saw a noticeable change in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I spent all my time taking care of her, and we didn't have the time to really have that bond. But when we got into a more supportive environment,
yes,
it became about being a mother and daughter again. And that was truly a gift. And I want to say thank you to all of the Brookdale associates who provide that gift to our residents and their families every day.
Yeah. You know, it was odd. I remember my mother saying to me at a point, she said, you know, I don't want you taking care of me 24 hours a day. That's no life for you. I don't want to suck all the wind out of you. Let's find a place where we can both have our lives. And that was like such a revelation to me.
You know, I wish more parents were like your mom. I will say that we have residents who just thrive in our environment. And a lot of people feel like they're princesses because they've got someone who takes care of the housekeeping, who takes care of the meals. It's really one life at a time that we change. Again, we offer the broadest offering of solutions at Brookdale than anyone, whether it's staying at home and providing home health, whether it's independent or assisted living like your mom had, or memory care, skilled nursing even.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people still do things at home but have people come in. But that's still a burden. But that's something that needs to be discussed. And it's great that situations like yours do occur. So Mother's Day is the time to see if you can strengthen that bond and see what the best thing is for everybody.
I absolutely agree. Senior living absolutely allows you to become your mother's daughter again.
Yeah.
And I would encourage everyone to start the senior living conversation with their parents sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Brookdale.com has the information that can help you do that.
There you go. Cindy, it's a pleasure speaking to you, and thank you, and happy Mother's Day.
Thanks, Ron.
Okay, you take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jack Vanderhey and Sarah Wiener join us now. Jack is a research director at the Nonpartisan Employee Benefit Research Institute, and Sarah is assistant vice president of the retirement at Principal. And we're talking about retirement confidence. I know there was a survey taken recently. What were the results of that?
Well, at EBRI, we just finished our 28th annual retirement confidence survey, where we look at 1,000 workers and 1,000 retirees to try to gauge not only what's happening this year, but also the trends over time as far as their confidence that they're going to have adequate financial resources to have a comfortable standard of living in retirement. This year, we actually found that among workers, the confidence went up to 64% from 60% last year. But among retirees, it actually decreased. Last year, it was at 79%, and this year, it's down to 75%.
Yeah.
The important point, though, I think, to keep in mind for retirees are those that are fortunate enough to have the traditional kind of retirement plan, the defined benefit plan. Their confidence level stays very, very high. It was 90% both last year and this year.
Okay. So would one say the closer you get to retirement, the more concerned you become of it?
Well, you become more concerned. Surprisingly, the confidence has been going up for older individuals. In fact, confidence is much higher for retirees than it has been for workers. Every year we've done this. Oftentimes, people think that because they're already in retirement, they don't have to worry about situations like, will I be able to work until age 65, as opposed to perhaps having an illness for myself or my spouse, or perhaps get downsized.
So I guess as the economy gets better, you get a little more comfortable. As things get shaky and unstable, then your concerns go up a little bit. I guess that's natural.
Oh, yeah. If you go back and look at the time series over this 28-year period, you get exactly what you would think in terms of market cycles, et cetera.
Yeah.
We probably had our biggest drops after the 2007, 2008, 2009 market correction, as well as, most importantly, as far as real estate values, because so many of these individuals are planning on tapping into their home equity for some type of retirement income support.
Yeah, I would say, Ron, the key to confidence is to plan. Americans spend more time planning for their vacation than they do for planning for retirement. And the more that they invest and commit time to planning their retirement, the more likely they'll be confident as the market performance goes up and down.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, Sarah, I guess as far as that's concerned, as far as product is concerned, it's always the goal to get people into a retirement program early as opposed to just realizing it later on. And I guess that's pretty much the gauge, isn't it?
It is. I mean, compounding is a beautiful, magical thing. So starting early is the way to go. But we as an industry have to figure out a way to make it easy for employees to save. So employers offering retirement plans, hopefully with an employer match, auto enrollment, auto escalation, hopefully access to a guaranteed source of income inside as an investment option, all will help workers save and have a better retirement.
Do some people feel like it's too late to start doing something like that to the point where it would make any difference at all? Is that a problem?
Sure, but that's a fallacy.
Yeah.
It's never too late to start saving. Yeah, you may need to work longer if you started later, but it's never too late. Employees should target around 10% of their income. If they started later, try to shoot for more. But $1 is better than no dollars, right? So start saving.
Yeah. Well, there was a time when people couldn't even pay their bills in their home. Most of us are not in that situation anymore. But my God, 10 years ago, a whole different story, right?
You bet.
Yeah. Okay. So give me some tips, either of you, on what we should be doing. What if someone is somewhat concerned or may be saying, all right, I have a retirement process going, but is it the best one for me?
Yeah, so one, save. It's never too late. Invest in saving. Two, invest time in planning. There are so many tools and resources out there. If you have access to a 401k plan, it's likely that provider offers tools and resources. On principal.com/retirement, we offer calculators to help with that planning. And finally, work with a financial advisor who does retirement income planning. If you incorporate those three steps, you will have much more confidence in retirement.
Okay. It doesn't matter if you're single or married or children or no children. There's something for everybody, I guess.
You bet.
All right. Well, thank you to the both of you, because a lot of people are concerned about that. And if not, well, probably they should be. Unless you want to work until you're 85, in which case, I don't know what job you have. So, thank you so much. One more time, the place we can go for more information.
You can get the entire set of results if you wait till 9 o'clock this morning
at our
website at ebri.org.
Or go to principal.com/retirement.
Principal.com, and that's P-A-L for those of you who, because there's two kinds of principals, we should say. Okay. Thank you so much for your time today. Pleasure speaking to the both of you.
Yeah, thank you, Ron.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, Ron. How's it going?
Hey, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
Yes.
thank you.
Yes, Dr. Len Friedland is here. He's the VP, Director of Scientific Affairs and Public Health, Vaccines, North America at GSK. And Jamie Scheinbaum is GSK spokesperson, meningitis survivor, and para-athlete. And they join us now to talk about stuff. You know, vaccination-wise, I know when you go overseas, you should get some vaccinations. When you go to school, they'll give you a couple of shots every now and then in grade school. But apparently there are vaccinations beyond that that have to do with school.
Well, Ron, this is Dr. Friedland. Yeah, this is really important stuff, and you're absolutely right. There are a number of vaccines that are important for our adolescents and also for our young adults so that we can remain healthy and protect ourselves against diseases that can be very, very serious.
Yeah, and one of them is something that I can't even pronounce all the time. It's meningitis. That's a mouthful, but I'll tell you, it's important. And apparently, Jamie, you've got some experience with this.
Yes, I also have experience with trying to learn meningococcal.
Yeah.
So it's very understanding. But yes, my story took place about 10 years ago when I worked hard to get to UT in Austin, and I couldn't even enjoy a full semester without contracting the disease. I got sick in November within 14 hours of my first symptom, and I didn't get out until May.
Oh, my God.
And I came out as an amputee in a wheelchair, lost most of my hair, and was 80 pounds. I was told to live my life, but I didn't know anything about this disease, and now I dedicate my life to educating people about this because, you know, I'm lucky. I'm lucky to have survived, and sometimes people aren't as lucky.
Wow.
Happy to be here today.
Well, Jamie, you're the best person to ask, what exactly is this? How did you contract it, and what is it?
I know Dr. Freeland can definitely talk about more specifics when it comes to meningitis, if you want to give it a go.
Yeah, I'll start in, and then we'll come back to Jamie and the story. Ron and your listeners, this is an uncommon and extremely serious infection that's caused by a bacteria called Neisseria meningitidis. For short, we just call this meningitis. And this infection can come on extremely rapidly, bringing people to the hospital, into the ICU within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. 1 in 10 people will die from this illness. Mm-hmm. And 1 in 5 who are lucky enough, like Jamie, to survive, can be left with lifelong sequelae, lifelong complications, uh-huh, such as blindness and deafness and loss of limbs. Mm-hmm. This infection is preventable through vaccination, and we now have 2 different vaccines to help provide protection against the 5 types of this bacteria. And these vaccines are for our adolescents and our young adults. And the best way to manage this illness is to actually prevent it, and that's through vaccination. And lastly, it's our adolescents and young adults, particularly those who are getting towards college age, that are at greatest risk because this bacteria is spread through close contact, through kissing and sharing, secretions, coughing and sneezing. And, of course, it's our adolescents and young adults who like to be around each other and are in crowded conditions.
Yes. College is a definition of those things that you said.
Yes.
Now, what about the person who transmits it to the infected? Is that person who's transmitting it, could they have it, and but it doesn't affect them? Why would not they be bedridden?
Right. So it's a really important question, and it just has to do with the way that this bacteria lives. Essentially, it lives in the human body where it's only host. So it actually just wants to be in us and not cause any problems. It lives in our nose and in our throats. Mm-hmm. Upwards of 10 to 15% of all adolescents, young adults will have this bacteria in their nose and throat at any one time, and it can be there for months, and it almost always causes no problems, but it does get spread from person to person, and occasionally it gets past our nose and our throats into our bloodstream, and then it causes the serious complications of meningitis and blood poisoning, which is what happened with Jamie. Why it happened to Jamie? She's an adolescent at the time, young adult who was living on the planet Earth, and it just happened. And that's the thing about this illness. It's unpredictable and indiscriminate. Essentially, we're all at risk. The risk is very low, yeah. but we're all at risk because we all are around each other.
So it's one of the, what I call a spin of the roulette wheel kind of disease, where it can happen to you no matter what you do, it can happen to you, unless you're inoculated against it. I'm never kissing anybody I don't know again, personally, after our conversation today. But seriously, Jamie, I guess the lesson is that you just don't know if it's going to be you. It's nothing you did, really.
Yeah, I was living my college life.
Yeah.
I was finally living by myself. I was actually off campus and still got meningitis.
Yeah.
When you're on campus, it's just a higher risk.
Well, yeah.
But since I was, you know, hanging out with friends, hanging out in their dorms, I was in the hospital within 14 hours of my first symptom, and within the first 3 weeks, I was in a semi-medicated coma.
Yeah.
I had tubes in my mouth. I couldn't talk. I watched my limbs basically turn black and were rotting.
Wow.
It was devastating, and I was like that for 8 months.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy to be here today and talking about it because, you know, if you're listening out there, I highly suggest to talk to your doctor. Make an appointment. If you're the mom, make sure you're making that appointment for your daughter or your son. And if you're the student going to college, I highly suggest for you to talk to your doctor about what vaccines you have taken.
So,
right, and Ron,
yes.
You know, vaccines are the best way to protect yourself against this illness. And your listeners can go out to meningitis.com to find more information about this illness, about the two different vaccines that can help provide protection against the five types of this bacteria, and become educated, and then go have a discussion with their doctor, with their pharmacist, about not only, to make sure you've had the opportunity to have both of the vaccines to help protect against all five of the types of this bacteria.
You know what's interesting, just as an aside very quickly, I have a dog, and I go to the vet, and my dog gets inoculated for five different things twice a year. And it's almost by law. I can't board my dog without getting these inoculations, etc. Yet human beings, I think all they get annually is a flu shot and then have a nice day. It doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, we live in a society where we have choice. The Centers for Disease Control recommends a number of different vaccines for our adolescents, young adults, not only against meningitis, but also to help protect against cervical cancer and against whooping cough, against, of course, influenza, as you mentioned. And so there are a number of different vaccines that are recommended for our adolescents, young adults, and those include to help protect against bacterial meningitis, which we call Neisseria meningitis.
Yes.
And the key here, though, is that because there are five different types of this bacteria, the way that we have vaccines to protect uses two different vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important to have that discussion. One of those vaccines is against what we call serum B as in boy.
Yeah.
And that's the most latest of those two vaccines. And so we still need to educate about that so that parents and students ask, this is the type of bacteria group that's been causing outbreaks on college campuses.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is let people know, and that's why we're talking to you today, let people know, have that discussion with your doctor, go speak to the health department at your college campus, and get educated so that you know what's available to help protect yourself against this illness, and it is really important.
All right. So the message is talk to your doctor, especially if you're going to a different school and that kind of thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. And damn it, go to your doctor. Everybody's got health insurance now. Go to your doctor, kids.
Right. And if I could say one last thing.
Yeah.
And not everybody goes to college, but every adolescent and young adult is around other adolescents, young adults, be it at their school, their sporting events, they go to clubs. So this is not just for people who go to college. This is for all adolescents and adults.
Have
this discussion.
Absolutely. It's actually called you're discovering your sexual life period of stuff. Let's be honest. That's what it is. Okay. Thank you so much for your time today, both of you. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron.
All right. Bye-bye. Hello, Amy.
Good morning, Ron.
Amy Hennessy is the Senior Advisor for the Consortium for Medicaid and Children's Health Operations at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And we're talking about spring and summer activities, a rather timely topic, as it is spring and summer coming up. And is that different than what we experienced during the fall and the winter?
Thanks so much, Ron. Well, one of the things that's different about spring and summer, of course, is that for many, it's allergy and asthma season.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to take an opportunity today to talk to your listening audience about health insurance through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, sometimes referred to as CHIP. Because we know, in addition to allergy and asthma season, spring and summer for kids is summer break. It's a fun time where kids are often outside. They might be swimming at the pool or the beach. They're mm-hmm. participating in outdoor activities and sports teams. And so we wanted to talk to your listening audience today about how they might get coverage for their kids to participate in those sports.
Okay. So more stuff can happen to people when they're out moving about. I guess is what we're saying.
Absolutely. That's right.
All right.
That's exactly right. So we know kids, and they're playing on teams, and in order to be on teams, sometimes they need to have a physical to make sure they're healthy enough to play. Kids climb trees, they fall out of trees, they break an arm, they need to go to a hospital. There's all kinds of things that happen when we're outside having fun.
Okay. And I guess part of the reason you're here is you do realize that a lot of parents don't know about some of these programs.
That's exactly right, Ron. So the Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, offers free or low-cost health coverage for kids and teens. Mm. And oftentimes people think, oh, I'm not going to be eligible
right.
for coverage. But what we want folks to know is that in most states, children and teens in a family of four may earn up to $50,000 a year to qualify for coverage. And in many states, family income can be even higher. So we encourage families to apply if their children don't have health insurance, and they can do that in two ways. If they want to apply online, they can go to a website called insurekidsnow.gov, or by phone, they can call 1-877-KIDS-NOW.
Now, is this a state-run thing that varies state by state, or is it a federal enhanced program? What is it exactly?
So it's actually both. The Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program are combined state and federal partnership.
Mm-hmm.
So each state has its own program that they operate, but it is supported by the federal government.
Okay, for now. And I hate to say that, but things are so shaky these days. But we'll talk about right now. Okay, so these are some ways that you can figure this out. So you told me the contact. Am I contacting my state or am I contacting my federal when I do this?
You're going to be contacting your state.
Okay.
So folks can call 1-877-KIDS-NOW, or they can go to the website insurekidsnow.gov. There'll be a tab that says Find Coverage for Your Family, and there'll be a map of the United States. They can click on their state and from there be directed to the application process.
Well, it sounds pretty easy. Now, application-wise, is it like Medicare where there's a certain enrollment period during the year?
That's a great question, Ron, and I'm happy to report that it is not. There is no open enrollment for Medicaid or the CHIP program. People can apply at any time of the year, and we think that this is a perfect time to apply. As we've been discussing, as we're anticipating the fun summer months, why not go ahead and apply today to ensure your kids have coverage and you have the peace of mind to know that kids are they'll be safe
right.
when they're out playing.
Okay. Now, for families, many of them have insurance coverage for the family through their employer and that kind of thing. Would this be considered, or for them, considered to be supplemental? Would there be even more benefits to this plan than there would be for most family plans that's covered already?
So this is not considered supplemental coverage. So the Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program are for kids who are currently uninsured.
Okay.
But with But with regard to what the programs cover, I think families will be very pleasantly surprised with the breadth of coverage. So the Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance program covers things like immunizations, annual checkups, eye exams, even dental visits, mental health services, prescriptions, and other care. So it is comprehensive coverage.
Do you think I could get away with saying that I'm 12?
No, probably not.
Sounds pretty good, actually. All right. Okay. All right. Well, this is now people know, and it's not just, as you say, it's not just for people that necessarily can't afford it. It's just not available to them through other means. One more time, how I make that contact.
Yes, yeah, so if you'd like to go online, we encourage you to go to the website insurekidsnow.gov, and via telephone, it's 1-877-KIDS-NOW.
Okay, and what's the definition of kids?
Right, great question. So the definition of kids, depending on the state, is from 0 to 19, and in some states, 0 to 21. But in some states, parents and other adults may qualify for the Medicaid program as well.
Right.
So if you are currently uninsured, I think it's a great time to investigate your eligibility. There's, you know, doesn't hurt to call or to go online and start that process.
Absolutely. It never hurts to make a phone call or to go online. Well, it can hurt to go online. You have to be careful where you go, but you know what I'm talking about. Thank you so much for your time today, Amy. This has been wonderful. You've told people stuff that I don't think they knew, and that's always a good thing. So thank you.
Thank you for your time today, Ron.
Take care. Bye-bye. Cheryl Young joins us. She's senior economist at Trulia, and we all know what that is. If you're looking for a home, the name of that company pops up all over the place. And Cheryl and I are going to speak about starter homes and owning a home. This is the time of year where people start looking and thinking and start buying and selling and all that kind of stuff. The economy is very, very good. The economy was also very, very good in 2007. We all know what happened around then. So you still have to be a little bit careful. So Cheryl, what do we do? What's the status of available homes these days? What's the market look like?
Well, the status really is there really isn't much out there right now. And what's out there is probably going to be much more expensive than it has been in the past few years. And starter homes in particular, they're probably going to be older.
Yes.
They're probably going to be smaller and maybe even, you know, more likely to be, say, a fixer-upper. So it's pretty tough out there.
Why is it so tough? Are people just not moving? Why aren't they? If the economy's so good, why wouldn't mobility go with that?
You know, I think there are still some signs that they were recovering from the Great Recession, and people are really have been reluctant to move since then, just because, you know, of the uncertainty in the market.
Yeah.
We know things are picking up a little bit now, so we might see a little bit more movement. But we also know that since the recession, we've really been underproducing housing. So all that pent-up demand and, you know, not many homes being built has really, you know, created a crunch in the housing market.
But, Cheryl, isn't that kind of good? Because when you build new homes, you're kind of like overdeveloping towns and cities and you know, overcrowding and taking trees and parks down. I mean, why wouldn't we take our older homes and do a little remodeling? Why wouldn't that be actually almost preferable, both dollar-wise and availability-wise?
Yeah, that's also certainly something. You know, we could also, you know, create more housing or better housing by, you know, fixing up some of the older housing stock. But I think the truth is that some of the economies in the country, we've seen really great job growth, like Boston area, for example, low unemployment, and, you know, people are moving in. So if you're adding population, you're really going to have to also add housing there.
Well, yeah, but like you say, I mean, it's different. The Boston area is probably one of the more expensive, well, it is one of the more expensive markets in the entire country. I think it's third highest in the whole country. So it's still rough, even though, you know, the economy might be be good. But what is somebody to do? Is the message don't move, or what is the message here?
Well, I mean, I think what we know also is that there are a lot of people looking for their first home. So
yes.
If you're out there, especially millennials, for example, they're facing a really tough market. And so, you know, what we do know is that they're probably going to have to make some trade-offs.
Yeah.
And with you know, so few homes out there, they're probably going to have to trade off something, you know, maybe in the neighborhood amenity that they want, or maybe a home feature.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, I don't think all hope is lost, but it may take longer. You know, your search may take longer.
Yeah.
And we always recommend, you know, engaging that local real estate agent to help you navigate the process. But there are other ways people can kind of get ready, and that is, you know, start thinking about your financial situation
early,
start working on that credit score if you need to, get pre-approved for a mortgage, start really saving for that down payment, because that's usually one of the biggest hurdles, and just get everything, get your ducks in a row, and so when you find that home that you want, you're ready to go.
Yeah, that's an important thing, which you said last, is that when you do this, be ready to do it, because I assume that if you see a home that you're interested in, it's not going to be there for very long if you don't act on it fairly quickly.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of competition out there. Homes are sort of flying off the market,
yeah.
And there are very few of them. So, you know, if the more competitive you can be, and
yes.
That's really, you know, in terms of financing, you know, the better your chances.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when I was younger, and it feels like I never was, to be honest with you, but when I was younger, my first home was not a pretty one. And but it didn't matter, because it was step number one in my long journey of having homes. So, I mean, I think the expectations of some generations are, because they watch television, they watch all these home shows that, you know, don't move unless you're moving into something of a palace. And it just doesn't, that's not supposed to, the way it's supposed to work necessarily, in my estimation.
Yeah, I mean, I do think people are realistic. We surveyed millennials recently,
mm-hmm.
and to get a sense of, you know, are they actually okay, you know,
uh-huh.
trading off or, you know, sacrificing something that they want in their home,
yeah.
Or their neighborhood. And over 80% of millennials said they're willing to give something up, you know, maybe
yeah.
it's a garage or maybe it's something like cafes nearby, but
uh-huh.
we do know that more than any other generation, maybe because they are, you know, facing such tough times in the housing market,
yeah.
they're willing to give things up.
That's good. That's a good thing. And it's tough the first time around, because you're buying into something that you don't have, you have no equity already in another home. It's, if you're selling and you're buying, it's kind of apples to apples. If you're buying for the first time, it's your first piece of fruit.
Right. And with home prices going up,
yeah.
you know, as if people wait, it seems like it's further and further out of reach.
Yeah. Okay, so where do we get more information? I mean, by the way, Cheryl's a real expert in this. She's actually beyond real estate. She's worked with some really big factions here. So give us some insight as to, well, you know, it's true. Give me some insight as to where people would go to ask questions if they have them and get some guidance.
Yeah, well, you could obviously check us out at Trulia.com/trends, and we have a wealth of research that we do on the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
You can also use the tools that we have on our site to, you know, help you search for the home and neighborhood where you'll love to live.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Micheletti joins
us.
Ah,
it's all good.
Yeah, it is good. He's the director of corporate communications at Unison Home Ownership Investors. And we're talking about purchasing a home, possibly for first-time home buyers or whatever the case may be. You know, it harkens back for me to 2007, 2008, when everybody was buying a home and everybody could afford one, and we got into a little trouble here, but that doesn't mean that you can't really still go for it.
No, that's true. And I think when you go back to what happened in 2007 and 2008, we saw this sort of proliferation of very low down payment, no payment type of programs
yeah.
that really enter the marketplace. And that, you know, overextended people, frankly. And that's what caused people to be underwater right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the credit tightening and Dodd-Frank and whatnot, we've seen things come back to earth, and people are having to go through the traditional ways of saving up for that down payment, making sure they're not underwater right out of the gate. So what we found in the survey was that people are very secure in their job.
Uh-huh.
They're secure in the economy.
Yes.
And that is leading them right now to think that they can buy a home. And when we think through that, we have to really sort of take a look at why they believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're the millennial crowd, they're first-time homebuyers, as you mentioned, and they're wanting to make that jump from renter to owner because they still believe in the dream,
right,
you know, owning a home in the United States.
Correct.
And that's good to see that people have rebounded back to that after seeing all the pain of what happened a decade ago.
Yes. Well, it's the old story why should I take my money and give it to somebody rent-wise when I could be being put into my own home as an investment. So
right.
That is, you know, that's the way to go. But for a lot of people, that's not necessarily doable. There's an interesting survey that was taken by your people there that home buyers would be willing to give up the right to vote for a 10% down payment if they knew that they weren't having to pay back.
Yeah, I think there were a number of lifestyle-related questions that we asked, and we threw that one in there just to see where sort of that litmus test would be. And you know, it was 22%, so a little bit more than 1 in 5 said they would give up the right to vote. But they also would give up going on vacation for 5 years, eating out for 5 years, or their dream car.
Yeah.
But looking at all sort of the lifestyle questions that we asked, the one that most people wouldn't give up was their driver's license.
Yes.
Only 9% of folks said that they would give that up.
Yeah.
And that, frankly, it surprised me because with the proliferation of all the ride-sharing tools that we have, the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world, you would think getting around town would be really easy.
Yeah.
But when I took a step back and really evaluated who we surveyed, we surveyed folks that were looking to buy in the next 1 to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, mobility is key. They are going to have to bring their kids to daycare, those soccer practices, going to work. That is something very important, and they did not want to give that up because it's such an instrumental part of their life.
Yeah. Interesting, though, that driver's license and car, that's something else that you have to, the car, you also have to make a down payment and you also have to pay off. So they're kind of almost similar.
That is true.
But yeah, you're right. And a lot of people live in their cars. And I don't mean that literally, but figuratively, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does one go about that where they want to become a part of that home owning society? How do they go about preparing for that?
So I'm gonna layer my question or my answer for you on this. I think most people have an unrealistic view of how long it should take them to save for a down payment.
Mm-hmm.
84% of the respondents said it would take them 4 years or less. In a majority of markets around the United States, to save for just a 10% down payment, it would take them an excess of 5 years with the median salary and median home price. So, A, let's get your sort of that reality check that it's going to take you a little bit longer. Two, at least the folks that we surveyed have less than $7,000 saved.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to be remarkably unsuccessful going into the marketplace trying to buy a home, qualify for a mortgage with those types of metrics. So, A, let's get your sort of financial circle buttoned up first to start with, to understand here's the reality of the situation. There are homes for you to buy, but you need to put yourself in a good financial place to be able to accomplish those goals. The second layer is that people really were struggling when they answered these questions. What was really was keeping them from saving? Student loan debt, credit card, car payments, as you just mentioned. And then the fourth big one was the cost of health care.
Yep.
So those four items really we're dragging down a household and their ability to save and making sure, you know, when we look at those four things, well, if you have all four of those, there's no way you're going to be able to save for that down payment. It's just not possible.
Right.
So what I think people need to understand is that the old way of buying a home going to that lender, the lender telling you you can qualify for X amount of dollars, that era is coming to an end. There are a number of companies in the marketplace right now that are bringing crowdfunding services, equity into residential real estate, like what my company does, to give people other tools to be able to fund that down payment responsibly, still borrow that 80% that you need to do to be successful, but still maintain this rest of this debt service that you have at the household level, so you're not putting yourself underwater, as we talked about at the very top of the show.
Michael, let me ask you a question. I think that what happened in 2007, 2008, I mean, the economy was booming then as well, and people were very gainfully employed back then as well. But it's that people, in my estimation, people overshot their expectations of owning a home. It's one thing to own a home within your means. It doesn't have to be a mansion. And I think back then, people thought if they owned a home, it had to be expansive. It had to be luxurious. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, just to own a home on any level is good.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that oftentimes people will go into a lender and the lender will tell you can borrow $1 million.
Yes.
That does not mean that you should borrow $1 million. You still need to go through everything that we just talked about and make sure that that dollar amount fits the budget, fits that monthly payment, and you can still service all this uncontrollable debt that you have
at
the household level.
Great. Okay, so what would someone do if they're listening to you and they're saying, okay, I'd like to find out more about this. What do they do?
So I think there's a couple things for people to do. Is, you know what, when you go to your lender, you're talking to your real estate agent, or you're talking to a loan officer, is ask them to give you more than one option.
Yeah.
We know that most people go into a lender, they get one option, one financing option. That's just not good practice. So go out there, get more than one option, financing options for yourself, and see what municipal programs, see what private institutions can do to help you get that down payment, because there are ways for you to do this responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
So for more information about our survey, if you want to see some of the other juicy tidbits that we found out, and at least from the economy and lifestyle components, you can go to unison.com/radio. That's unison.com/radio.
Okay, and then Unison is UNISON. And because we're radio, you can't see the spelling. Go for it. But like in anything else in life, find out all your options, get a lot of options, and make a choice from there. But to own a home is indeed a good foundation for everything. Thank you so much for your time today, Michael.
Thank you for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, there you have it. Thank you to all my guests, and thank you to you. I'll be back next time with a brand new show. Until then, I wish you peace.